From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
Compliment Terry's shirt and his conker back there.
And do you see the great mighty Pooh over there?
I can't see him. He's like, oh. I'm on the app, so I don't have any widescreen. You guys are wedged. Oh, that's killer. Oh, that's awesome. His corn teeth, I love it. Oh, he sings too. Wonderful. Mary Beth has abject horror. Now she's scarred.
What is that?
It's exactly what it sounds like.
He's the great mighty big poo from Conker's Bad Fur Day. He's just a giant poo with corn teeth.
He's like one of the boss battles.
That's fucking foul.
And welcome back. On that note, welcome back to Scarred for Life, the podcast where we open up old wounds by looking back at the films that scared us as kids. I'm Terry.
I'm Mary Beth. The last episode.
And each episode, our special guest brings with them a movie that traumatized them as a child.
This week, we're so excited because our guest is writer Adam Caesar. He's the author of many a book, including the Clown in a Cornfield series, and the writer of the recent indie horror release, Last Night at Terrace Lanes, that, in parentheses, I also executive produced. Welcome to the show!
Nice nepotism warning there, Meredith. How are
you? I'm like, no, please, here, ethically, I have to disclose that I am tied to this film.
You're ethically required to say that it is an incredible movie that's available right now on VOD. You can check it out. Hi, I'm Adam. Nice to meet you.
So you did lead with The Last Night at Terrace Lane. So can you tell your listeners a little bit about what the film?
Oh, it is a bowling alley horror movie. I wrote it, but it's based on a story treatment by Jenna St. John. The log line is doomsday cultists, figure out where they need to be, to invoke a final ritual that will bring about, kind of the end of the world. They're a little bit, you know, they're a little bit Heaven's Gate. They're a little bit culty. They have a mathematical bend to how they're figuring all this stuff out. And the place that they have to go in and kill everyone is, a bowling alley that is about to be knocked down for condos. So hence The Last Night at Terrace Lanes. I've seen like so many reviews call it a slasher, and so many people call it a slasher, and I'm such a slasher purist that like it, and they don't they, like it's not even like they're doing any kind of insult. They're like, oh, great new slasher movie written by Adam, directed by Jamie Nash, and I'm like, oh, thanks for the plug. And I'm just like, it's not a slasher though. That's a siege movie. Like there's structure to a slasher, and this doesn't have that. Like, this isn't.
I'll
this
show
isn't
you a
what
real
the,
slasher. Yeah. Throws your book at them and says, "Look,
yeah, exactly." No, it's like this one cheat. You know, and the Clown of the Cornfield books cheat the format a little bit. And that's kind of part and parcel with, you know, why I like writing them. But they're definitely way more, you know, they're way more of a slasher than Last Night of Terror Slayings is. But it's a siege movie. It's Die Hard meets Kingpin is the, I think it's Jamie Nash's line for it.
Yeah.
Hell yeah. It's very fun.
Very fun.
But mostly I'm a novelist. It feels weird to be on a podcast being like talk up your new movie. And it's like, well, not even with like a few film credits, I'm like, I'm not like a movie guy. Like, even though I guess I have written movies, but it's not how I think of myself when I think of myself, even though I'm like surrounded by thousands of horror movies right now, as you talk to
right.
me. I'm a movie guy in a fan sense and in like a, I study films since the bulk of my work and the way that I view my body of work is as a novel guy, novelist.
I know we don't have a whole lot of time for the interview portion, but I do want to talk a little bit about Clown in a Cornfield, because I have a very funny story, and I embarrassed my coworker because I said I was going to tell you the story.
I'm ready for this.
she's like getting into horror novels and stuff, and I had recommended Clown in a Cornfield. I was like, I think I've read the first two books. They're really, really good. And I think they're a good kind of gateway into that. And I was like, they're classified as young adult, although that kind of terminology is kind of weird to me in some ways. But I was like, it's young adult, so I think you'll be fine with it. And she read, I think it was the second, it was either the first book. No, it was the first book. She finished the first book and she told me, she's like, Terry, that book terrified the shit out of me. And I was like, really? Because I thought it was intense, but it never like terrified me. Like the last half of that book, I was like, page turner, like this is so nice. Good, but I don't get scared of books. And so I was like, really? She's like, yeah, I had to, she's living alone right now, and she's like, I had to go out, take my trash out, and it was dark and I was afraid there was someone out there, and so I didn't take my trash out at night, and I waited.
She's just living in filth because of Clown of the Cornfield.
That's
awesome. Exactly. What's her name?
Her name is Katie.
Katie, thank you.
I wanted to order one of your books. I know you'd get them signed through that one bookstore.
Yeah, I do. A local bookstore near me sells them.
A personalized book for her because that's just...
Yeah, we'll write something about how Frendo traumatized her in there. Thank you. That's wonderful. Yeah, I it's such an interesting thing, them being young adult novels, because you get so many... I get a lot of stories that like not like that's a very unique story, and I haven't heard that one before. But you hear from teachers and you hear from parents more than you hear from kids, because I'm not like mostly because it's like kids are not like reaching out, and it's also like I'm not talking to kids. right. So it's like, but I do hear from like a lot of teachers and parents and like different people, like librarians. I hear like from a lot of people it's like a very much like a gateway into reading and specifically into horror reading, which is like such a big honor for me, because like being on a show like this is like, I'm sure you talk to people all the time that, you know, you get in young with the genre, but it's just, it's something that, and I appreciate your hesitancy to be like, oh, YA, so it's so weird. Like I get a lot of well-meaning people telling me like, oh, it's not, you know, just like Terrace Lane's is a slasher movie. Oh, it's like, these aren't YA horror books. And I'm like, sir, madam, they really are, like they really, really are, and they were written that way, and they're intended to be that way. And just YA is such an interesting genre, and such a genre with such a spectrum of intensity and such a spectrum of like what is allowed. I think people hear YA and they, if they're movie people, they think PG-13, and that's not what these books are at all. These are hard R books, which is great for me as a creative and as someone who, in the beginning of my career, first three quarters of my career, were all my books were for adults, or I had written them explicitly for adults. And then I made this switch, and it creatively, not a lot changed, because I was still telling the kinds of horror stories I like to tell. But when I hear stuff like that, where it was, you know, it was your friends trying to get into horror or first, like it's a really beautiful thing, not to be too touchy feely about it, but it's really special to me to get to be a vanguard and to proselytize for this genre is really, you know, with the third book coming out, which is called The Church of Frendo, there is a little bit of almost a religious fervor to my love of this genre. I was a teacher for a number of years. I'm used to working with young people, and I was an English teacher, so I'm used to trying to get young people to read. And to hear that I've gotten young people to read is like super, super rad. And it's not something that it was explicitly like the goal of the books. The goal of the books is to tell a good story in a format that I enjoy, in a genre that I enjoy. But the bonus of that has been really incredible. And then there's I'd say 80% of my readership, like 70% of my readership, are just straight up adults that just like horror books, which is like also it's just this great have your cake and eat it experience of these books are, I'm hearing from teachers that want like signed classroom copies and stuff like that, which is insane to me, and people who don't have kids and have no interest in kids just enjoying the books as they are is super cool. And I'm very proud of a lot of my backlist and a lot of those books that were for adults, but I don't think that I'm prouder than anything than I am the clown books and influencer that just came out, which is another YA one.
So is there anything that we can like tease out of you for the third book?
This is a good dry run for this because I'm just like, the third book is so weird and so weirdly structured and has such weird things in it that are not in the other two books. The other two books are pretty, first one is a pretty straightforward whodunit slasher that goes really big in act three. Like things are very big as far as like body count and things that happen, but it still hews pretty closely to that format of that kind of slasher. Two opens things up a little bit and the political elements of the first one become a little more prominent. Loved. And because of what Loved was going that. On in the country, like that's what that book is. And then three is a much of a turn as you can kind of get and still have some of the same characters and some of the same themes. I can tell you kind of what I've teased already. I'm just trying to keep my story straight. Like I've teased like stuff like The Wicker Man, and like Blood on Satan's Claw and like folk horror. I've teased stuff like that. And then I've also teased like stuff that would seemingly negate that, which is like 70s road revenge stories and stuff like, Convoy, stuff like Hell or High Water. Like there's a string of that in there too, which is just, those aren't horror movies. Like those aren't horror, stories. So it's all that, but it's still, I hope not to completely alienate people that like the first two books. And I think there's that, what I told my editors is like, there's a precedent in slasher franchises to like have the weird one. Like, and usually the weird one for the first 15 years or so, people fucking hate it. And then they come around. Well, like the goal here is to get them to hate it just only for a couple minutes and then, and then really like it by the time the book's over. I was like, the goal here is to not wait like the 15 year period of being you don't want to wait for the, Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, like reappraisal to have to happen because no publisher wants to hear that. And then you're talking to like New York Publishing and they're like sweating margins and they're telling you can't have an extra chapter because like paper costs too much. So like, I started with that pitch and then I was like, but they're going to love it right away. Don't worry. That's as much of a tease as I can give you. I'm already planning on like August going on podcasts and like not talking about the plot at all because I kind of don't want to because I want people to kind of go in fresh. And books are weird because you usually send out so many like review copies and stuff like that, and people are on Goodreads beforehand. I'm just wondering how we're gonna thread that needle. I just really want to do almost like Hitchcock style, like. Don't let someone spoil, Clown of the Cornfield 3 for you. Because they wrote, ad copy, and I usually, edit the ad copy to, the nth degree. But this ad copy just ended up being so kind of general for it and stuff like that. It doesn't really tell you what the book's about that I was like, yeah, this one's fine. No notes. Like, just let it be the most, general, doesn't really tell you thing. So, but I'm really, really excited about it. And each one I've liked more than the last one. And this one's just, I'm really, really, really happy with it.
Hell yeah. Yeah. I'm very excited to read it because I was wondering I was wondering how you're going to top the first one because I really liked the first one. And I read the second one. I was like, this is so incisive about the culture that we live in right now that I fell in love with that one even more. So I'm at a fever pitch for the third one, I have to say.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, the three is, it's just like, I don't want to get your hopes too up because there's so many things about it that are different. And there's so many characters that are like minimal or like not returning that I know I'm going to be fielding Instagram questions about that. But it's like, I can only tell you that I have a plan and that it's going to be, everyone's going to get what they want. Exactly. Like, I'm not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I know what I'm doing to a certain extent.
Hell yeah.
Is this going to be the end or is there going to be more?
I do not intend it to be the end. I'm already prematurely. It's like, it's so weird how you have to learn how to talk about your own books and like how to sell them. And like, also like, you don't want to, if people want it to be a trilogy or they want it to be like this grand ending, you don't want to like disabuse them of that because you wanted to buy the book. But also, like, so many people are like, have already started using like the trilogy word with it, and I'm like, not a trilogy. Like, I keep wanting to be like, yeah, that's like, that's such a.
It sounds cool, guys, but that's not it.
It seems like such a publishing thing too.
Yeah. Okay.
These are weird books because they weren't a lot of time in publishing when people sell books, they sell them in multi book deals, or they sell them as series, or they sell them as trilogies, just because that's the way publishing works, and they know they can like budget out. And for time-wise, these books were not like that. The first book, which I still kind of get knocked for the ending, that there's a little tag at the end that like is like a the end question mark kind of tag, which is just what you do in slashers. People got so pissed at that because they're used to books being series, and it was like, no, it wasn't written to be that ending wasn't written being like, oh, this is gonna be, I'm gonna do this for the next 10 years. It was written because that's kind of what you do in slashers.
Yeah.
It just so happened that the book did well, and it's slashers. I want to do a sequel. So like, I was just, you know, the whole time I was texting my editor and being like, hey, we got nominated for the Bram Stoker one, maybe a second one. You know, I kept like, you know, trying to put it in his head that like, I would like to do more, but this was not sold as a trilogy. It was not sold in a multi-book deal. It was just sold one after the other. And each time basically like being like, I get on shows like this and I'm like, hey guys, please, if you want a fourth one, please buy the third one, because that we're Tom and Jerry where he's laying the track down in front of the toy train before, you know, like before he gets to it. Like, that's how this series is going. So I each one I try to end with a little bit of certain amount of definitiveness just in case they don't buy another one. And I also want to tell a complete story because they're not like serialized stories. They're more like film sequels in that, you know, until the MCU made everything, you know, made everything TV again. Like the idea is that like when you get a film sequel, you probably like want to tell my complete story here. So that's how they're composed and written. And because each one has its own flavor and its own themes and stuff like that, they're meant to be. They're, you know, one shot kind of things, even though you definitely have to read the first one, but to read the second one. I've screwed up this marketing thing so badly. So you're saying they're standalone? No, not at all.
You not at all. The other and yes, at the same time.
To your point, I would have been happy with the way the second book ended. It left me wanting more, but it would have given me a definitive, like it tied up everything that I needed to tie up in that book, while, as you said, kind of leaving the door open. So I can get what you're saying there. And I am, because I was like, oh gosh, is this it? Because I was really invested in the story. It's like, is this going to be it? And then when I heard that there's going to be a third one, I was like, okay, good. I'm here.
I'm not even going to say like four is my goal. I'm just going to say like, they're going to have to make me stop is going to be my goal.
Fantastic.
Yeah. All right. So Adam, let's talk about the movie you brought with you today. What film are we talking about?
We're talking about The Dentist, directed by Brian Yuzna.
So The Dentist, in The Dentist, an extremely successful dentist, surprise, goes off the deep end after he catches his wife cheating on him. That's pretty much the long and short of it.
That's it. I thought that was going to be longer, but that's exactly what it is.
That's literally it.
Does what it says on the tin.
Thanks, IMDb. Yeah. Very brief.
Yeah, that's complicated. That is.
No, it really isn't. So let's take it back. Why is this your Scarred for Life pick? Give us your horror story.
So I have a slight confession to make.
Okay.
While we were emailing back and forth to figure out what I was going to talk about, You sent a long Google Docs file with like 160 movies on it, and I had picked one. My first one was The Guyver, which is another Usna produced film directed by Screaming Man George. And I was like, this will be perfect. Oh, I've never gotten a chance to talk about. Oh yeah,
Screaming Man George directed it.
Oh yeah, it's got it's got an incredible kung fu pedigree. It's got an incredible visual effects pedigree. I was like, this will be the perfect movie to talk about during their podcast, because I've never, it's such an influential movie on me, but I've never talked about it on a podcast before. But we ran into the issue of, like, the Blu-ray I have of it is like region B locked. It's like an Arrow, like, import. I had to import it, and I have, like, the DVD too, and it's super old. I think it's, like, got disc rot and stuff, and the and then y'all, like, it's not streaming anywhere. There was no way for you to see it. So we had to pivot, and it was like, okay, choose another movie. And I had chosen Guyver so fast. I was like, oh, this will be easy peasy. Let me just choose another one. And I kept coming up with ones, and they were not on your list, not on your list, not on your list, not on your list. And so I went downstairs to, like, my pile of movies I'm intending to watch in the next, you know, few weeks or whatever. And I had the Vestron double feature of The Dentist and The Dentist 2 down there. And I was like, I wonder. And I checked your list, and it wasn't on there. So I was like, perfect. I've never seen The Dentist until yesterday. I've never, ever seen The Dentist. But the reason I picked it, outside from the Brian Usna connection, so I could talk a little bit about The Guyver, but was the fact that I was terrified. Of the when you think of, like, Scarred for Life, when you think of this kind of kinder trauma, this kind of you know, horror origin story, you don't just think of the films that you saw. You think about the films that you were too scared to see. And I remember very, very vividly at both of the video stores that we went to when I was a kid, because I guess the movie came out, I was like 9 or 10. Maybe the second one came out, I was 9 or 10, but it was, they were both out. And I remember walking past them both in Blockbuster and at the little supermarket end cap that we used to rent movies from too. And I just, the idea of teeth stuff and the idea of dental trauma and the covers of them were just so horrific to me that I was kind of like, as a kid, not knowing about, like, extreme horror and stuff like that, just seeing Freddy, seeing Jason, seeing Michael Myers, seeing these things that at that point, like, didn't even faze me. Like at that point, seeing their faces didn't faze me. But then seeing this, like, guy with a dentist drill going to town on someone, like, that to me, I was like, that must be the scariest movie ever made. In my mind, I was like, that must be, like, I didn't know Guinea Pig. I was like, that just must be splatter and torture from beginning to end. It must be the most horrific thing. And so for, you know, 35 years, that was got it, like, for not 30, we'll say. So for 28 years, that was my impression of The Dentist. And I was, you know, it was like time to watch it for this podcast and see how that stacked up with the things that traumatized me as a kid. And honestly, I think it would have traumatized me as a kid really, really badly.
Yes. So I do, before we do talk about that, I do want to talk about this idea of seeing movie posters and being terrified of them, because honestly, that was my life in, like, the late 80s, early 90s, where I would go to the store and I would just spend all my time looking at the horror movies and just coming up with ideas about what this movie is about. And sometimes they terrified the shit out of me. And there was one movie in particular that I'm surprised hasn't come up on the podcast, and I'm just waiting for it to come up, is, so I'm just going to share it now, is Deep Star 6, a movie where the cover... Is,
oh,
this,
that, ooh, like the, yeah.
The diver suit that is, like, half gone.
That's like half, and I'm, yeah, yeah.
Yes. And I remember as a kid going, because I, aquatic horror in me is like, I love aquatic horror. Aquatic horror is like my sweet spot. And especially things under the water, like in labs under the water, that kind of stuff is like, perfect. And I see this as a kid and I'm like, this movie has to be awesome. This movie has to be terrifying. What tore this guy in half at the bottom of the ocean? And, like, the tagline was, save your last breath to scream. And I'm like, what is this movie? And then I remember seeing it, like, years later and being like, that's what this movie is. But
it's a little goofy. Yeah,
it is a little goofy. But that buildup and seeing those movie posters and then, like, realizing you know, that is that movie that sort of scars you as a kid for life without even having seen it. So I do love this, that the dentist is like the thing that was like, what the fuck is this? This is going to be most horrifying thing ever.
It loomed heavy in my psyche. And I ended up really liking it. So I'm glad we were able to talk about it on the podcast.
Well, and it's funny because I had a similar experience with The Dentist 2 specifically. I haven't seen but the cover with like the razor blade teeth. Ooh. Haunted. So there's a couple movies that like always haunted me at the video store and the, like their covers. And then I would always like run past them like they were watching me. And it was this one and Carved, the Koji Shiraishi movie where it's about the slip mouth woman. Anyway, but like, The Dentist I don't remember the dentist cover, but The Dentist too, because that fucking pale face is staring right at you with the open mouth of
and
razors.
The white, and it's white, and it's so it just, so it's all stands out.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the evil version of like the Fright Night 2 cover. It's a similar, it's almost like glamour photography where you're doing that fade into white thing, but it's like the most horrible image.
Ooh.
And it's, and I'm really talking about these two almost in the same breath because they were right next to each other. And it was like him, the cover of the other one's him coming in with the drill, and the cover of that one is that image. So it's like you add them together. It was like, to me, it was like, I was like, I can't believe they made two of them. Who's letting them get away with this? Like as a kid.
Well, and like, I'm assuming we all have a similar feeling. It's like, I've always been scared of the dentist. Like, I don't like the dentist. Nothing about it is pleasant. And just the thought of a horror movie about a dentist when I was younger was like my worst nightmare. I was like, I'm already scared of them. I don't need to be even more scared. And if I had seen this as a child, I would have never gone to the dentist. I can almost guarantee you that I would have been like, absolutely not. I also would never have thought at a younger age about dentists assaulting women while they're under anesthesia. So like that, I'm glad I didn't have that exposure as a child, because that would have ruined me from any male medical professional for the rest of time.
Yeah. It's a pretty horrific movie that walks a real weird tonal line. Because it's really bleak, but it also has that, I think it's written by Dennis Paoli and Stuart Gordon.
Yeah,
and it feels like one of their things. It feels almost like, because it's for people who haven't seen it, it's hard to describe the tone of it, because it really feels like, in a way, it feels like a dry run for Stuart Gordon's Edmund, which I think at this point he had probably like directed the Mamet stage version, because I know that he had worked on Mamet stuff before. So it's like it has that real descent into madness, almost like a realistic version of Descent into Madness. There was a third writer on it who came in for a rewrite, and I think he might have used it up a little bit. And I think the original script, watching like special features and stuff like that, was like, the original script was like condensed time. It was all supposed to take place in like basically from when he leaves in the morning, seeing his wife cheat with the pool boy, to like the very end. Like it was meant to be just like almost like a rampage thing, like where he basically
like
goes
that.
Into the office late. Yeah. It's weird. It's weird to put time jumps in.
It felt like, I was like, is this going to be a one day thing?
Yeah, it's weird that like that it is over 2 days, because it's like almost doesn't need to be.
It really is.
Why did they change it? But I like the movie that it is. But like Mary Beth is saying, it's pretty bleak, and it's pretty. And then like then there's this, using it as like a kind of like he's not the world's most technical director, but he is a director of like style and like cool shots. He's such an interesting, and I think such an incredibly underrated director, because this and two are basically the only ones of his movies I haven't seen. I'm pretty sure there might be some straight to video stuff I haven't seen, but like I've seen all his, you know, I've seen his Silent Night, Deadly Night sequels, seen Society, of course, but it's just, there is a real continuity between his stuff of like otherworldliness and weirdness, that I think fits the script really well.
And what do y'all think? Yeah. Well, I didn't know that this was directed by him until I started looking up information about this before I watched it. And I was like, wait, this is a Brian Usna movie? Did not know that. And it's really weird. I was talking with Mary Beth offline that this is like synchronicity, because just last week we were talking with Joe Lynch about Suitable Flesh. And that is also written by Dennis Paoli.
Yeah.
And it was originally intended to be a Stuart Gordon movie before he passed away in the 2000s. And so seeing that and then coming into this, like, wow, that is what a weird What a weird thing that was not planned.
Staying in the Gordonverse. Yeah, yeah.
Well, and it has such, like, and thinking of Suitable Flesh, but also, like, Stuart Gordon, it has this, like, sleazy 90s erotic, gritty, gnarly thriller vibe to it. Like, everything about it. Like, I did not expect this to be as erotic and horny, like, negative.
It's horny, but if it's horny in that way, there's, like, not at all arousing, you know?
No, like, no, yeah. Yeah, it's just horny, negative, in parentheses. Like, horny, like, not arousing, horny, and, like, deeply uncomfortable. Because it's, like, incredibly erotic, but, like, in the most uncomfortable way possible. And it's just like this, like, he's just a sleazy dude in every like meaning of the word. And but my favorite is that everyone keeps saying, like, of course he did this, he's a dentist, and like they're playing it so serious, like they're like noir detectives, like proving some crazy point, but he's just a fucking dentist. But they play it like this, like they play it like a direct, like a sleazy direct TV 90, which is exactly what it is, direct to video. But I love that. Like, they lean into the sleaziness of it, which I was not expecting. Like, way sleazier than I expected, way weirder than I expected, and way more disturbing than I expected it. I thought it was like, oh, like a weird dentist doing fucked up things. But I'm like, oh no, he's like really like gone crazy. Yeah. Like, he's having an actual psychotic break and is hurting people.
And it's
with
done, it's played fairly straight, that like that you know, it's not like he's not becoming Freddy Krueger, he's not like full of quips and stuff like that. It's like, no, this guy's losing his mind in like
a
kind
of, you got dirty teeth and I gotta clean your fucking teeth, and I'm like, you know what, it's fucking weird, but like it's not like I don't even know if it's that, like, I don't know, it's not like he's, like you said, he's actually under some transformation, he's just like, he's having a psychotic break. Not scary as shit.
Yeah,
his performance kind of reminds me a little bit of Jack Nicholson in The Shining, where he starts really unhinged and then just gets more unhinged because he, like, I love this opening where he's like, beautiful wife, beautiful home, perfect life together.
Yeah.
And he starts talking about the stench of decay, and it's very bright. It's very soap opery. It feels very Lifetime channel-y the way it's shot. Yeah. And then immediately he is yelling at his wife about how, like, you know, my shirt has a stain on it, I can't wear it now, and I can't use my diamond cufflinks, like, rich problems, right?
And he's like, he's unhinged, and he's unhinged before anything ever happens, and he's such a dickhead before anything happens, which I think is such a good way to play it, because it really, I feel like with a movie with this exact almost plot, you'd be a little worried, you'd be a little bit like, well, is this movie whose side is this movie on? Is this like there's, you know, like the, like it's a film with like so much misogyny in it that you start to like want, you in any other situation, if you almost didn't have that little lead in, you'd be like, wait a second, like, is this supposed to be like, oh, his wife's sleeping around, so he has like a, you know, and it's like, no, you get immediately like you get immediately like what that woman's situation is, and why she would like not want to deal with this guy at all. Like you get who he is like so quickly, and it's like he's so, and I like that he narrates. I like that it's like his narration is juxtaposed with the reality of like of his situation, where it's like this guy's like sucks from the moment you meet him, and is like sociopathic from the moment you meet him. He's just not violent. And I think there's like a, you know, the interesting, like, movie saying something interesting about, well, what would just be that one thing? And I think it's almost like a very like 90s thing. It's almost like a very 90s, like the beginning of kind of true crime daytime television. Mm-hmm. There's that erotic, erotic basic cable, like, are we an oversexed society? Is this like a Red Shoe Diaries type like look to it and lead in, even though nothing is like sexy or cool? Like it is like this, just, it looks, the house looks nice, but everything else is gross. Like, and it, you know, form and function with this idea of like this decay that is creeping in.
Exactly. I was like, that's actually kind of smart, the idea, because like everything is so pristine and everything is like on the surface. Like, he is a professional, like, you know, he's very well respected. He's a good dentist, it comes across. His dentistry has like themed rooms. Like, it feels very like presenting just wonderful, lovely things. And yet, like, he complains about there is rot just underneath, and he is rotten to the core, even though he's presenting. And so, like, there are some interesting things that the movie is kind of sometimes clumsily, but like exploring through that kind of metaphor, I would say.
Also, Mark Ruffalo is in this.
the fuck?
Yeah, he doesn't just have one line. He's like there. He has like that whole little scene. I really like the Mark Ruffalo character because it shows you how messed up this world is, because he's like grooming a child who's there to get her braces off. But he's like, it ends up being somewhat weirdly, like, has to be like the indignantly justified indignant, like two scenes later.
And it's a just hero, like, and like a weird thing.
And he never gets in the dentist chair. You never get to fuck up Mark Ruffalo. Like this dude sucks and he's going to keep on going. Like, he kind of like avoids the dentist entirely. You know, he sidesteps his comeuppance, which in any other movie that of this era, especially of like the HBO Tales from the Crypt style era of everyone wanting to do that EC Comics kind of morality tale. Like, the fact that Mark Ruffalo just walks off like and is fine, like, is like kind of tells you that something's a little different in this movie, you know?
Yeah, because everyone who gets hurt and killed doesn't deserve it, except for maybe the tax guy.
And the tax guy gets it so bad, and then he's like alive for a long time.
Oh God, I know. It's like the tax guy's bad.
The tax guy's almost the kind of victim you expect them to have. Like, he's just
he's
such
like the
a
evil
cartoon.
Villain. He's like the cartoon evil villain. That's so funny. And I love that because he's like, I've seen your returns. And I'm like, this is fucking hysterical. We're talking about taxes. Like, we all like are all very well versed in how diabolical the plan is, that he's not going to file it to his boss. I'm like, this is incredible. 10 out of 10. I know that they're like, I know they're playing this as straight as possible for the comedic value. And I love it so much. And he absolutely destroys his fucking mouth. But it's like
his whole head. He gets like a chin prosthetic.
Yes. And like the rest of the movie, this guy is just like murdering women and like the pool boy and then hurting children. And it's just like, it is weak. You know what I mean? Where he's just like hurting everyone who doesn't deserve it. And you're like,
no.
Jesus Christ. Ugh.
It's funny because I never wanted, speaking of hurting children, I never really wanted to see this movie growing up because.
Incredible transition.
I have had since, like, I would say either high school or college, and it's gone away, but, like, one of the two recurring dreams I used to have was that my teeth would just start to crumble in my mouth. And it was always, like, it was always felt so real to me that, like, I would wake up and I'd start crying. So, like, I have no teeth. Like, that was literally, for the longest time, I honestly thought that my teeth were just not even just falling out. They were crumbling in my mouth. And so seeing that poster with this is like, I can't watch
this.
Yeah,
of course. No, yeah.
But I will say that the teeth scenes in this still get me. Like, this is my first time watching this movie as well, but I'll tell you, those, even though like it is definitely a giant mouth, and according to the trivia they could only afford one mouth, so they kept like replacing the teeth in it to
the
like
puppets are
it.
Awesome though. The puppets are they awesome are. They look so good, but
it's horrifying, particularly the one where he's using the like weird drill thing and it like literally destroys the tooth.
It just obliterates that tooth. Yeah. Oh God.
It's what made me think about my dreams. I was like, that is what it felt like in my dream. Just like the tooth crumbling in her mouth. It is like, I literally gasped at some of these.
The thing, even like if you're under the nitrous or if you got like Novocaine where you can smell what the dentist is doing, like, and stuff like that. I feel like when you see that scene, I could smell like the burning tooth kind of smell of that. It's so bad. Like, that's why I'm like, I'm all in on this movie. I just saw it yesterday, but I'm like, I kind of wish I'd seen it as a kid, but I'm glad I didn't. But I'm kind of like, now I'm like, I'm team dentist. I'm team Corbin Burnson and the dentist. I just wasn't expecting it. It was one of those things, like, you know, like I said, it loomed large as a kid. And then I was like, well, I never really hear about the dentist, so it must not be that any big shakes, you know, like it doesn't get talked about a whole lot. So it kind of just. I don't tend to like doing that, just being like, oh, if it's not in the zeitgeist, people aren't talking about it, maybe it's unworthy of watching or discussion. But I was just Mary Beth saying like the 10 out of 10 when the tax guy starts getting it. That's how I was for like most of this movie. I was like, oh boy. Like, I was just very surprised by it, I think.
I will say, this is when it got me. When he was holding his wife in his fantasy, holding his wife's head down on the pool boy, saying, show him your teeth, show him your beautiful teeth. I was like, look, this is fucked up and incredibly abusive, but the fact that this movie in 1996 is going there, I greatly appreciate it, and I am on board for whatever this fucking weird movie is about to give me, because this is not even remotely it. So I appreciate that, because I really was quite surprised.
I was not ready for
that. Most of the step of the way in this movie, and I love when movies do that. I love it. It's a great time. And I was smiling, which is weird to say about this movie, but I was like, you're right.
Yeah. We get the incredible gun over the fireplace, like the Chekhov's gun of the girl with the braces that keeps getting delayed. People keep skipping her in line, and she like comes 2 days in a row. She's so excited to get her braces
she cancels
off.
Her and you're like, party no, kid, for her
no, don't get your braces off. Don't do it. He's like the bad dentist. I love that. You almost play that through the whole movie. Like I like that's genius to me. That's so funny.
We're watching her become the final girl without being realizing she's gonna be the weird final girl of the dentist. And you're like, this is ridiculous. And like. The liminal space hell of sitting in a dentist waiting room for days on end
of a waiting room getting hit on by Mark Ruffalo, like it's like this it does so many things. It replicates so many things about the dentist experience that aren't just like dentistry. The idea of, like you said, liminal space, it's almost like the DMV, and you're like I guess the front desk ladies are kind of nice, like but I don't want to have to spend all day here. Like it does so many things that like are like realistic, and I think this is a kind of indelicate transition, but this idea of like the 90s and what this represents, I think his kind of weird take on like dentistry and how he wants to improve dentistry is kind of interesting, because it lines up so well with like 90s aesthetics and what the 90s were about. This idea of like themed restaurants and going big and everything's like new, and we're pushing boundaries out of, you know, we're leaving like the opulence of the 80s and moving towards an almost like more holistic, self-helpy version of like of 90s understanding and of a certain 90s enlightenment, which I think this movie calls bullshit on fairly, you know, directly. But like he has like themed dentist rooms. He has like one is a concert hall, and one is like a rainforest, like the cute little
heaven?
Kids in the rainforest. Yeah, one's
welcome
heaven.
To heaven.
Like, yeah, and it's like you go in and it's all this like it's all decorated from like the nature store, and there's like the CD
my
changer
orthodontist
that the,
was like
yeah,
that. Yeah. I remember my having themed rooms. I do remember that.
Did they play the rainforest sounds for you? Or?
They did not play the rainforest sounds. They did not do that, no.
When I had braces, my orthodontist was just one big line of chairs. It was like out in the open. It was not individual rooms.
So they
it was
had
like
that.
Big, like six
they had
chairs.
Some
yeah.
individual rooms when you had to do more work, but it wasn't just a checkup. It was the chair. It was like the chairs.
Okay.
So I had a hybrid dentist experience. Okay. Hybrid orthodontist dentist.
I just remember
experience.
Being like factory farmed at the, you know, at the
Change those the orthodontist out. What color do you want?
Yep.
Do you remember as a kid, like the flavored stuff they would use to polish a tooth? What kind of flavor do you want? Yeah. Did you ever have that?
Oh, I fucking hated that shit. I didn't even care. I did grape once and almost vomited, and I was like, I don't want it anymore. This is the worst flavor. Yeah, no, fucking hate the dentist.
It's the texture of it. It's the grit. Yeah,
it's
like
grit.
I don't care that it's bubble gum
it's
if you're
grit.
Like if you're sanding my teeth off. Yeah.
you know, just before we wrap up. Sorry.
Well, I wanted to say that I love the two dental assistants, and I was so sad of anyone in the movie. I was so sad that they died, because they were Karen, played by Patty Toy, loved her, and Jessica, so good. And so it really made me sad when they got killed. But like I did not go into this expecting to actually care about some of the characters. And yet here I am with Karen and Jessica in particular, just like, I want them to survive. I want them
to
live.
And they do their jobs great. And they're like, they seem like really empathic people. They do like they do everything right. Like when things start to go a little off the rails, it's not just one of those like, oh, you know, Dr. Finestone's having a crazy day. They like investigate it and press and like, and try to do the right thing, which I think is just very different than a lot of characters you would get. I feel like in a film of this time, of this budget, like you wouldn't, there's a little bit more, humaneness to it, even though like these characters, like it's, you know, it's got sad deaths in it, and it's got like you know, kids in peril, and it's like very, but it's very almost responsible in the way it does. It's like misanthropy, you know, if it makes sense. If that makes sense to me.
But before we wrap up, just Adam, when you were talking about the 90s aesthetic and tech, it made me think of Dead Ringers, the David Cronenberg movie, and how weirdly Dead Ringers might be an interesting double feature with The Dentist, because I mean, like, it does feature like a medical professional kind of slowly losing his mind and perfecting medical equipment and using the medical equipment and kind of going on a rampage. And I'm like, huh, that's the weirdest double feature, but it kind of works though. Like, it does kind of work. Yeah. I mean, obviously very different visually and tonally, but also thematically, like, not too different. Have you watched Deadfingers yet, Terry?
Yes, I have finally watched that. In fact, weirdly enough, the episode came out today that I recorded with Joe. So it's out there as of today.
But is it like almost being on the pioneering edge and what that does to, you know, like, I think Jeremy Irons is a little bit more of a complex, you know, character
I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do think there is something to that. And there is, you know, there's the, you know, gynecology dentist is this idea of just like ultimate bearing of yourself and something that's doesn't seem right. Doesn't seem like there should be a person doing that to, like, even if it's under the auspices of medicine, like, just teeth stuff is just,
it's very violating. He has him like putting his finger in her mouth. And like, it's just like, again, like, sorry to be up, like, orifice is being violated in both movies. Yeah. Like,
that made me so uncomfortable. I was like, oh, I don't want to ever be unconscious at a hospital now.
This is why I typically go with female doctors now as an adult woman.
I will say that this movie sent me on a rabbit hole, as sometimes happens, about, like, has there been any serial killer dentists? And I did find the weird story of Glennon Engelman, who was an American dentist.
Sounds like a serial killer.
A contract killer and a serial killer. Oh. One of his people that he killed was in a car bomb.
Where was this?
He was from St. Louis, and he planned and carried out at least 5 murders for monetary gain over the course of 30 years. He was already serving 2 life sentences in a Missouri state prison when he pled guilty to the murder of a man and his wealthy parents in a separate contract killing that occurred in Illinois.
Hitmen are rare. Real hitmen are way rarer than like serial killers. It's like he's a little bit of a unicorn there.
Yeah, and they put him his death toll at between 5 to 7 plus ?
Wow.
Because he could have been more. The exact number is not known, and the methods he used to kill his victims included shooting, bludgeoning with a sledgehammer, and explosives.
Come on, dude. Wow.
He should have been around to watch Corbin Bernstein work. Yeah.
And exactly.
Sledgehammer. That's, I mean, no dental records after that shit. You're getting your head smashed in. On that note, Terry, are we ready to wrap up and give us a rating out of 5? Adam, so get you out of here for bedtime. So Terry, how many destroyed teeth, speaking of dental records, out of 5 do you give the dentist?
You know, it's weird. When I sat down to watch this, I was like, I'm not sure how I feel about this movie. But by the end of it, I had come around to it to the point that my roommate was like, so when are we going to watch The Dentist 2?
And so I think
we're going to watch that this coming weekend. So so that is my journey with this movie. It has a weird pacing, a weird feel to it. I can definitely tell that things were changed from probably the original script. And I am curious to see what it would have felt like as like a single day of this man going on like a rampage vice, the kind of break that it has. Really weird. Some really good effects, particularly for I believe this was made for HBO streaming, so it was like initially like that was the, not even streaming, what am I talking about, HBO television. Like, wrong. I'm streaming on the brain. But this movie is weird. I love Brian Usna. I love everyone involved. I had a good time with it. I'm gonna give it three destroyed teeth out of 5 personally. What about you, Mary Beth?
So I had a similar journey in terms of emotionally, being like, I have no expectations, but I'm ready for it to be fun. And then being like, oh my God, like, this is kind of fucked up. I found myself quite fascinated with how shitty this character is and how they really don't give him any redeemable qualities or not trying to make him some kind of anti-hero. It's like, I got very like Patrick Bateman, American Psycho vibes, but if he was a dentist and didn't work in banking and like didn't do a lot of coke. So it was just like it was much more fascinating than I expected. And I actually gave it 3.5
Ooh, okay.
Destroyed teeth, I think. But Adam, you have the final word.
I'm a lot easier on my scales than you two seem to be. But I'll go 4.5 destroyed teeth, because I really want to be the ultimate dentist defender.
Yeah.
Here. Yeah, okay. I really, really, really love it. Yeah, it was a great time, and I'm glad we got to talk about it right after, because I watch movies. I like text my buddy like, that was pretty good, and that was like, that'll be the end of it. But I'm glad we got to have a discussion about it. And I'm sorry I had to use subterfuge. Sorry I had to lie to you guys.
We still got to talk about it, so that's totally fine.
You're gonna have to make me a promise though, when because I think you said that the Guyver is supposed to be coming out on Blu-ray later this year.
I think Unearthed is putting it out. Yeah, Unearthed is okay. putting out a 4K, like finally a domestic Blu-ray. Yeah.
So I'm going to need you to come back and talk about that one. Maybe to promote Climb in the Cornfield 3.
Maybe we have a little bit more time. Yeah, no, that'll be perfect timing.
I'm going to need to have you come back.
If you don't lose like a bunch of subscribers from this episode, I'll come back. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. No, because I just... The Guyver's so interesting because it's based on a manga and that was an anime.
Oh, I know.
Like, and it got me, me down a bunch of different paths kind of in my life and in my fandom, I think, like, because of, you know, the Yuzna-ness and the Screaming Mad George-ness and like, and the, you know, martial arts. It's just like a lot of things that I like that I still like later in life that I was exposed to just like as like a 6-year-old, like that all kind of follow through. So I think it's very interesting movie to talk about in that context, and it's good. I like it a lot.
When it is out, I'll be
right back in this chair. Yep.
Because I was so excited once you said it was directed by Screaming Mad George. Like I'm
it's co-directed. I forget the co-director's name.
Steve Wang.
Yeah. It's a co-directed thing with Screaming Mad George, and there's just effects out the wazoo. It's got like a lot of cool puppet effects, a lot of cool suit effects. Like it's got stop motion animation in the transformation scenes. It's really cool. It's got Mark Hamill. It's great. It's really a fun movie. It's one of those things where I'm like, I don't, there's like a weird amount of watching it now as I've seen it as an adult, and there's like a weird amount of like, comic relief that like probably doesn't work as well if you're not 6, like, but everything else about it is still like, it holds up perfect and it's still badass. But like there's this weird mix of like Brian Yuzna's kids movie is what this feels like in a certain way.
I'm so excited.
I'd love to come back and talk to you about that. But
well, thank you so much, Adam, for coming on and finally getting us to watch
thank
The
you
Dentist
for
and finally
me.
You watching The Dentist.
I'm so glad.
I just want to say that I've made it this far without singing "He'll Be a Dentist" because like that was in my mind the entire time I was watching this movie.
He has a knack for causing great pain. Yeah,
exactly. thank you so much, Adam. Yeah. Where can our listeners find you, and the floor is yours to plug away whatever you can talk about.
Where can they escape me? There's no way you can't find me. I'm on TikTok, which I'm getting real good at. Watch out.
You are.
Watch
out, world. Here I am enjoying your TikTok
stuff.
Oh, thank
you. Hey. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, everywhere. And if you just type my name into Amazon, all my books come up. As Terry mentioned, if you want signed books, I have links on my website, a local bookstore. The Children's Book World, which is so weird going into a children's store with like Babar like painted on the side and like being like, all right, well, I'm gonna go sign these books where a girl gets beheaded and then kicks her own head as her body runs.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Exactly. Yeah. Very metal children's bookstore. But they'll ship you. If you're in the US, they'll ship you signed copies.
And listeners, I will put the link to that directly in the show notes so you can go click
awesome.
And order.
Thank you. Thank you.
Awesome.
All right, listeners, you've heard from us. We want to hear from you. What was your experience with The Dentist? You can let us know by sending us an email at scarredforlifepodcast@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on social media. I am at MB McAndrew on McAndrews. That's my name. Drews, not without a W, Lucas. Jesus Christ. What have you been a week?
And it's only
Tuesday. And then Instagram at mb.mcandrews. It's Tuesday. Oh my God, I thought it was Wednesday.
Right. Well, it's Tuesday, yeah.
30 year old. And I'm at Gaily Dreadful everywhere.
Then don't forget to follow the podcast on social media, at Scarred Podcast on Twitter and Blue Sky, and at Scarred for Life Podcast on Instagram. See, I can do that one, just not my own name.
And please don't forget to review, rate, and subscribe. And if you want to help support us, we do have a Patreon.
We sure do. Thank you to Eric Power for our artwork. Thank you to Sean Keller for our music. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please stay safe out there, but most importantly, stay creepy.
And until next time.